Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening, Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host Han Tran. Han, how are you this evening?
I am doing super, Jim.
Excellent. Excellent. We're not too bad. It's a little cold up here, but that's what you expect in, just 2 weeks away from Christmas, and we'll get through it. I think somebody was on the TV for the news station and said, only 100 and some days to springtime.
it's spring somewhere. Okay.
Yeah. It's spring somewhere. And actually, that's kind of an interesting topic. We have seen a large increase in the amount of dentists who are thinking about springtime, thinking about what to do. Should I start planning now? And it's actually a good time to do that. But tonight's topic is a different one in that, it's basically not something that Han and I have come up with. It's what you've come up with. Tonight's topic, episode number 55, is questions from our listeners. So, one, we're thankful for everybody that sent in the questions. Keep it up. You can do that on our website. You can, if you have and would like to ask a question live, feel free. You can call us on our number, 657-383-1442, and you'll come up on the screen here, and we'll see what we can do about answering. Like Han likes to say, you don't have to give your real name if you don't want to, right?
That's right. We can find you, but you don't have to.
Exactly. Well, tonight's show is an interesting one because some of these topics actually could be larger full shows, but we'll give it our best shot to squeeze them in between the hour time that we have available to us. And, feel free, go to our website. It's obviously www.hjtdesign.com, and you can get a lot of information there. Let's start out with Han. I'll let you have the first question.
All right. This is a discussion that come up from time to time, and I think it's a worthwhile topic to discuss. The question comes from Dr. Tom out of Utah, and he said that I'm looking at a startup practice located within a commercial office building that has common areas, and within that common areas there are restrooms. What is your thoughts and recommendation on whether I should provide in-suite restroom facility for staff and patient? Very good question. Okay, there's a couple of things that we would want to check out, or you should check out, to confirm the first. What is the minimum requirement? What is there, and is it truly ADA compliant? I mean, being accessible or ADA compliant is important. So if the common area have public restroom that for all the tenants to use, that's the first check. Is it ADA compliant? Secondly, even though there are common ADA compliant restroom facilities for the tenant to use, a tenant and their guests, to have access to use. Some municipality will also require that you provide in-suite toilet facility, ADA compliant toilet facility within your suite. So that would be the second question to confirm and ask, because if they require, then you know you have to provide it. In the event that it is grandfather and the public restroom is there and everything's good, the next question that you should ask is, what would be the pros and cons in having my own in-suite ADA or in-suite restrooms? The office thing is convenient. The second thing is, if you want to install a restroom facility within your suite for your staff and patient use, the question that you need to ask is that, does it have to be ADA compliant? Okay. Some municipality would make you install ADA compliant or ADA adaptable, which basically means that it's the same size minus the the grab bars. Okay. If there is real estate available within your suite, we highly recommend it. Mainly is that when you have patients, it's convenient for both you, your staff, and your patient. If you have a patient in the chair, receiving treatment, and they say, I got to go to the restroom, they can step out into, out of the treatment room and go to your in-suite restroom and be back, as soon as they're done. Or they can leave your office and go into the common area, and then they disappear for whatever, however long, and things like that. It become very disruptive. It become more disruptive than if you have it in, within your suite. So our recommendation is, don't improve the patient experience, and minimize that disruption, and provide the convenient, put it in. Install at least one within your suite for that purpose. Okay, Jim?
Yeah, I've had that happen. One particular project that I worked on in my career, it was actually a multi-use facility that had an atrium. And in that atrium, all the tenants they were owners, different uses, but owners of the building, had entrances off of that. And in that atrium area was a restroom facilities. Now, the building official, code officials were okay with the restrooms being located there, specifically allowing handicap accessible restrooms out there, because one, the criteria is that everybody in there was an owner, and effectively the whole building was looked at as a whole. And two, you didn't have to go outside, meaning you didn't have to exit the building to get to the restroom. Like, you would have to go outside. We've all been in some of those lifestyle outdoor malls where basically it's
yep.
building after building after building. You walk outside, walk up and down between the shops, and then all of a sudden, here's a pile of restrooms, and you go over to the restroom area. In that case, you didn't have to go outside. You stayed within the building envelope. Now, it was a requirement, though, that the fixture count, that's an interesting thing. By code, there's a certain required number of fixtures based upon your occupancy and your square footage. That's how you establish occupancy, is by square footage. So you had to use the whole building to establish the fixture count. And so if you're going into a facility like that and you have the possibility of using fixtures that are in a common space, you got to make sure that there's available fixtures to be utilized. Here's a prime example. If you've got five different users within your building, each one of them requires two fixtures, you know, that's a total of, you know, 5 times 2, 10. But the common restroom only has 8. Well, you're deficient by 2. And so the building official and the code folks are going to say there needs to be 2 additional as a minimum, maybe more. So those are 2 other aspects that need to be checked out when you're looking at that kind of situation. And you know, that's not an aesthetic kind of thing. That's a technical kind of thing. Hunt, I think you accurately described the aesthetic part of it. You know, do you really want a patient getting up out of the chair and going out of the building, you know, out of your suite? Do you know, now, if you're in a situation where the local municipality, for example, has a very heavy fixture count requirement, let's say you need to have, you know, 4 fixtures, and well, maybe you can use 2 of them out in the common area and 2 of them within your space. So you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Jim, there's a couple of approaches to that too. Is that since they are in a common area, one of the approaches to have, you know, to update the existing restroom within the common area to the current code requirement with the current fixture count to meet that requirement. Okay.
Right.
Of course, the other approach is if you have only 2,500 square feet office space, it would be an overkill to, let's say, the building require an additional 4 fixture count. It would be an overkill to have to put it into your suite because it would eat up a small chunk of real estate. So every case is handled different. Every case is analyzed different. You know, we often recommend that a code analysis is done that are specific for your your space of interest and how the building, you know, the sum of all the pieces and parts within the building affects your space. So doing a code analysis is pretty crucial to the success of your project early on, so where you have no surprises. Hey, Joe?
Absolutely. Cool. Well, I've got a question from Dr. Mark over in Illinois. And he came up with the question that he's looking at a piece of property, and he says, it has a drainage easement that runs across my lot. What does that mean for my building? Now, he's in a situation where he's looking to build a new facility on a vacant piece of land, and there's this thing labeled on there known as a drainage easement. Well, a drainage easement is, let's start with the first word, the second word, easement. An easement is a legal section of a piece of property that has been defined by a legal document written that says specifically that this area from point A to point B in these coordinates has been defined for some reason, and it's set aside for that use and only that use. And it's restricted in the sense that a lot of other things can't happen within that. That's what an easement is. And then there's all kinds of different types of easement. There's water easements, electrical easements, utility easements, access easements, parking easements, cross access easements. There's just a ton of them. So obviously the first word being drainage easement. Well, that refers to that this particular easement has been laid out and set aside for drainage. Now, it could be because it's in a floodplain and that particular area historically would flood. And so the municipality has established a drainage easement and said, we're not going to let people build within that. or it could be that it's a waterway, a creek, or a stream, or a wetland, and they've established a drainage easement and said that's where the wetland or creek or waterway will be, and you can't physically build in it. That's the other important part of this, is you can't build in it. You can't build over it. You can't build on it. It's basically set aside. You can't park on it, typically. You can't really do anything on it. It's just going to be there. When Han and I see these things, and let's say we pull up the aerial of a piece of property that a site survey says drainage and easement, we'll look down on that aerial, and 9 times out of 10, we'll see just a whole bunch of trees or a whole bunch of bushes or a whole bunch of cattails. And all of those define that that area has been set aside. It's, like you say, either creek or wetland or something to that effect. Now, how is that going to affect your building? Well, it's just that. You won't be able to build on that property. You won't be able to build on or do anything with it. So you've got to configure your new facility in such a way that it doesn't encroach on that. Now, there are some possibilities, and it's on a case-by-case basis, where you can actually go in to the governmental authority that has jurisdiction over this easement and rework the easement. That's done a lot of times with creeks, streams. It's also done a lot of times with even wetlands, in that they will allow you to rework those within some restriction so that you can maybe maximize your piece of property and still contain or keep the water component on the site. Because it could be a drainage easement that the city is using or the municipality is using because they need to retain water, and as the rain comes in, they need to slow it down, so they back it up on a series of ponds or little drainage areas that flood, and then it slowly dissipates out through their system as opposed to a big deluge of a whole bunch of water coming down the drainage ways and then into their system. So the latter, meaning the moving and reworking and adjusting, is an inexpensive endeavor. That's a cost that could be anywhere from pennies to tens and possibly even hundreds of thousands of dollars. It all depends upon the scope. It all depends on what they're going to require of you. So be real careful about working with or looking at or purchasing properties that have these kind of things on them before you do your homework. Get a seasoned professional that understands this stuff and have them do a review and give you the options. I mean, Han and I, we've talked about this before in other projects and other things. It's like, sure, it may take you a few bucks right now to hire somebody to do that, but what do you save in the long run? You could save tens of thousands of dollars in the long run if you don't have that information as opposed to having it.
Well, if you don't have the information and the purchase price is really sweet, you know, like you get it for a song, you can inherently buy yourself, you know, a truckload of problems. Sometimes cheap is not cheap, may be a curse. Okay, so do your due diligence. And because you can buy, let's say you need, you know, 3/4 acre to meet your building and parking needs and stuff like that, and you found yourself 3 acres of land, you go, you know, that's a lot more than I need, and it's pretty cheap. And you find out that after you do the research and find that there's easement that you cannot relocate, you cannot build on, and your net usable real estate is only half an acre, you'll be in big trouble. Okay, so this is where you, as you look at the property, hire professionals that can analyze the property and give you some some directions and guidance, so that way you know whether it's a property that's worth buying and whether it's going to work and meet your current need as well as your future plan. Jim?
And that's a real scenario that Hans talking about. It wasn't 3 acres, but we did have a situation where we had a client that had a 2 acre piece of property. And once we got through all the particulars, and this, and specifically in this one had to be with landscape easements. That's a nasty word, landscape easement. And it was a big one. It was a very large landscape easement. It ran 50 feet from the right of way all the way along the whole length of the property. Effectively, his 2 acre piece of property was reduced to less than an acre of buildable real estate.
That was part of the master plan by the city to create a green belt development, and so it set the property. Your setback is affected. I've worked on project where when the building is done, they were able to use it. It just happened to be like a little drive-in ice cream. Burger joint, and they know that within 5 years, that development of the roadway will actually wipe out their front yard, and that affects the way the traffic coming in, and affects the traffic stacking for the drive-through and things like that. So it's worthwhile, when you look at properties, to have the research done, so that you know what to expect, future development and how it's going to impact your own particular parcel that you're looking at and purchasing.
Yep, without a doubt. Han, what's your next question?
My next question. There is a protocol. And a process when we deal with design. I often see in recent weeks as well, and some of our design critiques and stuff like that, the term had thrown out as this is the way things are done in priorities, function, form. Aesthetic and budget. And I think when you're talking industry jargons and stuff like that, it defines exactly what that means or the significance and priorities of each, each item is important. Jim and I discussed it a little bit. We have been in the field for a long time. For us, if our client is a dentist, the function of his or her building is to provide dental services. So the main function of that building is to provide dental treatments and so on. Okay. Every building has its purpose, the core purpose of what that building is designed for. Whether it's a gas station, a church, a factory, a dentist's office, they have specific function. Everything that you think of related to that building is secondary. The shape of the building, the form of the individual rooms and things like that are a matter of subjective desire, but it supports the core function of that building. Aesthetic is another thing. And Jim, you probably, you can enlighten a little bit on that area. Because sometimes you find projects that that others pursue, they seem to put the aesthetic in front of as a highest priority, you know, compared to all the other things, and aesthetic drives the entire project. You want to share a little bit in depth on that?
Absolutely. And actually, we cut our teeth, and we were trained under the principle that form always follows function. The idea of aesthetics or form taking the lead priority is not one of a successful project. It may be beautiful, don't get me wrong. I mean, and there could be a requirement for that, but it's not a solution for a practical use. What you're talking about is something that is more of a monument, or something that becomes a piece of art, or something that becomes some other use. But from a usable building, form and aesthetics always have to follow function. And of course, you know, the budget component is just, that's part of, like Han was saying, the supportive part. But we kind of like to use the idea, draw a circle on a piece of paper, and write the word function in the middle. Then throw a bunch of spokes coming out from that, and you can put everything else out there. You can put form, you can put aesthetics, you can put budget, you can put anything you want out there. The core nucleus is the function of the space. If your building does not function, it's a failure. It has to function properly to be able to be a success, and everything else will follow behind. Now, don't get us wrong. Aesthetics is extremely important. What it looks like is beyond important. We've done a whole show about first impressions and the aesthetics of the building, and having to do with how your building becomes your signage and all that stuff. Yes, it's all very true, and it is very important, but it doesn't lead the decision-making process. The functionality of the building leads the decision-making process, and then everything else follows in behind. So you have to have a building that works and works very well. And of course, you know, we would love to see and be part of wanting to be an aesthetically pleasing building for a whole lot of other reasons as well, to give you a total successful project as opposed to one that just purposely functions. Because actually, if you do that, if you create just a functional building, theoretically it could be a warehouse. It could be a pole barn. It could be a factory. Those are examples of very functional buildings that don't have a lot of aesthetics to them. They're just purely functional. So aesthetics is important, very, very important, because, you know, you wouldn't want to have your dental office in a factory building or in a warehouse building or in a storage container. That wouldn't give the right impression. Han?
But I think, you know, I think first of all, you know, you focus on the things that that has the highest priority. At hand, it would be function. Aesthetic is very subjective. Okay, for some, it could be simply give me bright colors. I love bright colors. Okay, and that's the aesthetic I want. Or very minimal. You know, just shiny surfaces and wide open space with very little furnishing. Okay, but aesthetic. It's always evolving. Okay, if you approach a project with a notion that you have to have the aesthetic is important and you have to have it like that. There was a recently, maybe a couple of years ago, there was a commercial by Kohler, the faucet company. You know, a husband and wife came into a very swanky architect's office, and she pulls out this faucet and she say, "Built my house around this." Okay, that is the prime example of putting the cart in front of the horse. We don't encourage that. Yes, aesthetic is important for, you know, for the creative creature that we are, but you can take, once you do the layout of the building with all of necessary space, define the functions and how it flows and how everything interconnect, everything work together and stuff like that, then the aesthetic, the embellishment of the space could be refined, fine-tuned, add-on to give you that wow factor you look for. But aesthetic serves secondary to function. Okay, Jim?
Absolutely. Let's go to our next question. I've got Dr. Sandy down in Tennessee. This is an interesting one. We've got a heating and air conditioning in my operatory. What's the best system that I should use? My existing ops are all different temperatures, and we can't make the temperature even out. Well, you know, that's a very complicated but at the same time very common issue that we run into. And there's a lot of possibilities and a lot of systems that are out there. First of all, let's talk about orientation. If your building is oriented in such a way that some of your ops are on the north side of the building and some of your ops are on the east or the west or the south side of the building, you're going to have different heating and cooling requirements, only because of everything from having to do with the solar, having to do with wind, having to do with just how they heat up or cool down because of the outside environment. Do they have windows? And you know, are those windows the ones that face to the south or face to the north? So orientation is important. Now, if you're an existing kind of building, you know, you can't really do anything about that other than maybe look at window treatments and shading devices and those kind of things. Now, if you look at it from an equipment standpoint, so your heating and air conditioning system, there are systems out there that allow you to effectively zone each one of your operatories. And each operatory can theoretically have its own thermostat in it so that you can, to use her words, even out the temperature. Because each op will be a different temperature based upon a lot of factors. How it's being used, how much air circulation is going into it, how many people are in it in a given period of time, those kind of things. Now, that system is the Cadillac of systems. It's expensive, but it gives you total, complete control over each individual operatory. The normal system is one where you have a heating and air conditioning unit. It has a ductwork. That ductwork runs to all your operatories, and there's a diffuser in your ceiling or floor, and the hot or cold air comes out of the diffuser, and you'll have a thermostat located somewhere. And that thermostat will only heat or cool based upon the temperature of what it's at somewhere. That's more than likely what she's experiencing because that thermostat is saying, let's, you want a temperature of 70 degrees, but it's, you know, at the cold side of the building, or it's at the hot side of the building. And so, you know, that's why you get different temperature swings. There's a variable speed system or variable temperature system that's really kind of cool that allows for a common ductwork, basically a forced air heating and cooling system. But then at the diffuser, there's a special thermostat, and that thermostat will open and close based upon the requirement of that particular operatory. So that kind of gives you a little bit more control over that operatory. Not total control, but a little bit more control. And then there's another one that has a reheat system in it where it effectively brings the air in, and then it will either reheat or cool it down based upon what's necessary. Those are a couple options. Then there's also options where you put things like individual units in the wall. A lot of people call them mini splits. The real term is called PTEC. Those units are in the wall that augment maybe the air that's coming into the space and will allow you to individually thermostat each one of your operatories to be able to heat and cool those. So it's a it's complicated. There's a lot of ways of solving it. It's much easier when you're building a new building as opposed to renovating. But it can be adjusted and can be done. Because we all know that the biggest criteria, going back to that function versus form kind of thing, the function is that space has to be comfortable. It has to be comfortable for the patient. And it has to be comfortable for the doctor and the technician. Hon?
Let me throw my pennies in there, John. I think we preach a lot about the patient's experience, okay? And I think it's important to strive to provide the best patient experience as possible for the patient who come to, you know, to your practice for treatment and so on. The other important factor that we often neglect or put into a secondary category is the need of your staff. You're the dentist. Your staff are moving from room to room. It's almost like you are participating in a day-long marathon. Okay, you're not running, but you are working fast paced, going from treatment room to treatment room to treatment room and repeat. You're gonna naturally, the biggest complaint that we get and heard is that the building's too hot. We're too hot. Naturally, you're the only one that are gowned up, masked up, and moving. So I think it's important that you have the discussion with your design team. They should understand that your comfort is also important. For us, the traditional cooling and heating system that most buildings have, the simplest trick is where do you put the discharge? You know, the supply grill, where it heat or cool. Cooling is more important. So we usually put the supply right around your work zone. That's right about the just above where the doctor sits, or the right shoulder of the patient. So that way, that work zone is cooler than the rest of the room. And that way, you and your staff is a lot more comfortable. If the patient gets a little cold, naturally you give them a blanket or something, but they're only there for a short period of time. It's you that in my opinion, they need to be, addressed for your comfort all day long. Okay, so the simple, there is trick and a trade. that could address it without an awful lot of investment in control. But Jim mentioned, you know, I list a number of heating and cooling systems that depends on your budget, depends on how much you want to invest. You can literally have the flexibility to control each individual space. That can become problematic too. You know, express your wishes. For us, the simple, the simple trick is locate where the supply, the air supply closest, where it's closest to the, to the dock and the staff, which would be toward the front of the room. And that usually address the bulk of the complaints or the bulk of their needs. Jim?
Right. Now, unfortunately, that flies in the face of the normal requirement of a lot of mechanical engineers is they want to put that heating unit or air conditioning unit over by the window because
yes.
that's where the largest heat or cooling loss happens is through the glass as opposed to through a wall. So those two have to be looked at. Sometimes you end up with two diffusers within your space, one at the doctor zone that Han talked about, and then one over by the window to augment that requirement and that issue. The other thing to think about in this scenario is cold air falls and hot air rises. So if you're in a cold air environment, predominantly Florida, you would look at having those mostly in the ceiling. Whereas then if you're in a where you're going to be doing a lot of heating, a lot of times a floor diffuser is a better solution. But usually, unless you're in the, far bitter north, usually cooling is the predominant one. So that's why you'll see diffusers up in the ceiling more than you will in the floor, if that makes sense. Let's see. Han, what you get to be next. I did the last question. What do you got?
Yeah, this question is almost similar to what you were just talking about, the orientation. This is from Dr. Mark out of Ohio. He said that I'm looking at a space, an existing retail space, and is it important that the solar orientation of the space need to be taken into consideration? The topic of solar orientation often come up as a discussion. If you are developing a raw piece of land, placing your building, so you can take advantage of the best ideal solar orientation that Jim had talked about just a few minutes ago. When you were working with an existing building, like a retail strip or a commercial office building, and there's a suite that's available, and that's what you're trying to work with, you don't have too much choice. You can't rotate the building. You cannot upgrade the construction assembly of the wall. If you're lucky, if you're leasing, the building owner is in the process of updating window and kind of going to a more energy efficient windows and so on. But there's your ability to address the solar orientation of the space is very limited. The things that you can address would be window treatment, the type of window treatment that you use. Maybe film. If the building, if you're allowed to put awning and solar shades and stuff like that on your building, that's great. But that requirement or that desire minimize the effect of the heat gains and stuff like that is pretty limited. So you just kind of work with what you have and address it the best you can. Jim?
Right. Right. One of the things that we run into specifically with retail centers is historically you've got a front wall. That front wall has a door in it. The front wall has glass in it. You've got two side walls. Yeah, usually 90% of it's glass. And then the two side walls are solid. If you're lucky, you're on an end and maybe you have a few windows. And then you have a back wall. That back wall has a door in it. And that's your back exit/entry. And that's it. That's your box that you get to work with. And so from a solar orientation standpoint, from the question, all you get to address is which direction does your building face and what do you have to do to that front set of glass. Now, there are times where, let's say, you feel that you'd like to have more light, natural light throughout the space. In that scenario, the really only way to accomplish that is to put in solar tubes or skylights. If the tenant or if the landlord will allow you as the tenant to do that, then there's a cost incurred of punching a hole through the roof, patching the roof and putting up the necessary solar tubes or skylights to be able to put natural light deeper within the building. They can be quite attractive, but of course they come with a cost. Hon?
Yeah, most of your building owner are not really warm to the idea that you're going to put holes into the building, into the roof. But, you know, you should probably ask. Ask early on when you are negotiating the lease, okay, to see whether that's something viable. A design trick that we've used is, yes, in the retail space, you have predominantly all the windows you have are usually at the front of the building. And so the front of the building usually are occupied by a waiting room. So the waiting room or waiting area and perhaps your front desk is the only area that get to enjoy a little bit of daylight. The trick that we often use, it's effective for the area beyond the waiting room, maybe a little farther. We call it borrow light. In other words, the wall that is dividing the waiting room and your clinical area or area beyond the waiting room, it can be out of glass, or it could be, or we could have, you can call it clear story, or the higher portion of the wall have glass so that you can borrow we call it borrow light because you borrow the light that come in into the waiting room and get distributed a little farther into the building. Okay, so that is another design trick that we employ to bring more daylight farther into the building. And you don't have to modify anything, you know, the building envelopes or the roof. But the discussion with the building owner, whether you will be allowed to put in solar tubes or skylight to allow you to bring in more natural light into the deeper into the space should be something that you discuss early on. Okay, Jim?
Yeah, because, well, I mean, prime example is a lot of the big box stores, the Walmarts, the Home Depots, the Myers and such, are using a series of skylights throughout their buildings to augment the lighting and reduce the need for artificial light. And it's kind of interesting when you're in those buildings, when the cloud goes over the sun, all of a sudden they get a lot darker inside. I don't know if you've noticed that, but next time you're in one of those stores, watch that and see how the light changes. And it's pretty drastic, especially if you're in a place like a Walmart, one of the newer Walmarts or those kind of places that have a large portion of their ceilings are covered with skylights. Just an interesting phenomenon, which, you know, we tend to see that kind of stuff because we, you know, that's the world we live in. I've got go ahead, Hon.
Let me take 30 seconds, Jim. Actually, when it comes to lighting, artificial or natural, it depends on, I would implement this if you own your own building, okay, is that there are technology that integrate the lighting fixture and the solar tube or light tubes and skylight so that it when the outside lighting level is adequate or high, it would turn off your interior light or to that specific area, you know, to the area where you implement the technology. So it's part of the energy conservation movement, but you know, you can look into that if you're thinking about you know, building a new building, because it seems like it's kind of an extra expense to integrate into a space that you lease. And Jim?
Yep, and very much so. That's a little bit more expensive, but actually could in the long run save you some money. Especially when utility costs tend to be higher and higher. They don't go down. I haven't seen them go down. They always go up. Okay, I've got a quick question here from Dr. Paul over in New York. Now, Hon, you won't be able to address this question because it's very unique. Can you build during the cold winter months, and how is this done versus summer? I mean, you know, down there, you guys build all the time. But, you know, up here where it's nasty sometimes and we get cold, the answer is, Dr. Paul, yes, you can. Now, there are some unique things that have to be addressed. Make sure you get someone who has expertise in, one, building in the cold winter months, and two, a design architect that understands that that's what you want to do, because there are building systems that can be utilized that are designed specifically or have an advantage to be used in a cold winter build as opposed to only a summer build. There are special admixtures that are placed into concrete and mortar and those kind of things so that you have the possibility of putting concrete down in the winter months within reason. I mean, sure, you can run into situations where, you know, it's minus 20 out there or something like that. That's a little difficult to build in. But if you're in a normal, you know, 35 to 20 degree temperature range, I mean, the contractors tend to pick the nicer days and they do the things that are heat sensitive during that time, and then they protect what they've done so that the next component that goes up maybe is not weather specific and can help to again protect that. It may be a situation where your project and or if it's an addition or something like that is small enough that they end up just tenting the whole thing and they can provide temporary heat to allow the project to be continued. A lot of times what we see what happens is, let's say a project gets stalled and doesn't get finished in time before the winter comes in. And then you run into that situation where, hey, I've got to try to put brick up and it's too cold to do it on a normal basis. Then you have to go into that winter mode construction and figure out how to do that. But make sure you get yourself a design architect who knows that's what you're looking to do or that's what you have to do, and definitely make sure you get a contractor who has experience in doing that and talk with his or her past clients that he did it for. It's one thing to say, yeah, I can build in the winter. It's another thing to do it successfully. And what's it look like? How has it performed? Did it hold up? You know, all those things you need to ask of that reference. Juan?
I think the scenario that you're talking about, Jim, by the way, I'm familiar with coal construction, all right?
I know,
just
I know.
You
used to live up there.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the scenario is that if you are working with a very time-constrained schedule and you don't have any other choice to build during the winter months, okay, there is you need to realize that there is a premium in cost for winter construction.
Yep. Okay? There's an up cost. Yep, there's a little up cost.
Yep. Yep. Okay. And it is, like Jim said, it is important that your construction team can deliver what they promise. Okay. Because it's rather rude to discover that they have never built anything in the coal before when they're on your project. So it's, there is an awful lot of hybrid systems that allow buildings to be designed and built in the extreme cold, and the building, could look very, very aesthetically pleasing. Ask me how I know. Done this, okay? But you need to know that up front. Everybody on the team have to have a in-depth knowledge of coal construction methods.
Yep. I mean, there's some really cool things out there, some really, no pun intended, cool, but there's some really exciting systems. I'll give you an example. One is an ICF. Let's say you're building a basement or a foundation wall, and you need to pour it in the wintertime. Well, a normal construction is you're going to build that basement or foundation wall. You're going to put up formwork. You're going to pour the concrete in there with the rebar and all that kind of good stuff. You're going to let it cure. Then you're going to pull off the formwork, and boom, you've got yourself a wall. Well, that only works when the temperature is above freezing. When it's below freezing, and the prime example is utilizing what's called an ICF. An ICF it stands for insulated concrete form. It's actually a block of foam with a face panel on the front and the back, separated by several inches, could be anywhere from 4 to 12 or whatever inches, and held apart by these, a lot of them are now just plastic little brackets. And you stack these things up, and you pour the concrete in the middle of them. Well, what happens is concrete creates its own heat when it cures. Well, because you're basically pouring it into a styrofoam insulated wall
like
system,
a cooler
that holds the heat in, you effectively can pour a concrete wall in sub-freezing weather and do it in such a way that you don't have to sit there and heat the environment or the air around it. You cover the top of it, you pour it, and boom, you've got yourself a wall. So there are some pretty cool systems out there that allow you to do that kind of stuff and extend your building time frame and or even build all the way through winter. So, Mahan, we've kind of burned up our hour, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's the ICF system that Jim was talking about, that is something that's not all our contractor are familiar with. So every hybrid system should be research and make sure that your project team is familiar with it. But it is a very good system to use. That would give you the flexibility to pretty much build any time of the year. Right? There's plenty. Yeah. We can talk about building all day long. Just as long as you have the people on your team that are familiar with the system and stuff like that, that would ensure your success. Jim?
Yeah. Well, without a doubt. We want to thank everybody for, keep sending their questions in, keep giving us those things you want to hear about. We'll address them as we can throughout the show. Want to thank everybody for listening. Hopefully it was informative. You learned a few things, or maybe you took away something that you can give to an associate who maybe asked you that same question. Obviously, if you have any questions, give us a call, catch us on our website, send us an email. We're here to answer those questions. And obviously, Han and I enjoy doing this, and we're thankful for all the folks out there that hopefully have been able to benefit from that. So with that, we'll look forward to seeing you next week. And Han, I'll let you have last words.
I can't believe that we blow through an hour that fast, Jim.
That fast.
I had fun. Yeah, I have fun. And certainly appreciate all of you spending the hour with us. Until next time, have a great evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.